today we're talking about family inheritance. We're asking, on the one hand, why children of writers choose to follow in their parents' footsteps. Maybe continuing the literary legacy is simply an expectation. Virginia Woolf once wrote that her desire to write was like being harnessed to a shark. Her father was the Victorian critic and biographer Sir Leslie Stephen, and her mother was Julia Duckworth Stephen, who came from the well-known publishing clan. Stephen King's two sons are writers, so is John Updike's, and Anita Desai's daughter Kieran is a novelist, one with a Booker Prize, unlike her mum. And then there's the rivalrous British father and son novelists Kingsley and Martin Amis. Here's what Martin Amis had to say about literary legacy. He's speaking on American television some years ago.
Most children of writers who are writers themselves tend to write one novel or one book of stories and then shut up shop, because the rivalrous feeling with the father or the mother, the writer, mother or father, has been satisfied by that. But I never felt that, and I wasn't really doing it to have an effect on him. It was for myself.
That's British writer Martin Amis. Joining me now to discuss literary families and legacy is Zachary Leader, Professor of English Literature at Roehampton University. He's also edited The Letters of Kingsley Amis and written the biography The Life of Kingsley Amis. He joins us on the phone from his home in London and stayed up very late to accommodate us. Thanks for joining us, Zachary.
I'm pleased to be part of the discussion.
And with me in the studio is Barbara Kane, Professor of History at Monash University, author of Bombay to Bloomsbury, a biography of the Strachey family. And in Sydney, we're joined by Australian writer Tom Flood, author of the novel Oceana Fine that won the Miles Franklin Award in 1990. And he's also the son of the late poet, novelist and dramatist Dorothy Hewitt. Welcome to the Book Show, Tom.
Thanks, Ramona.
And Barbara, welcome.
Thanks, Ramona.
Well, let's start with Zachary Leader. You say that Kingsley Amis was not only the finest British comic novelist of the second half of the 20th century, but a dominant force in the writing of the age. Now, certainly that's leaving big shoes to fill. But how would you describe Kingsley Amis's literary legacy to his son?
One thing right off was that he enjoyed his life enough to become a kind of model for his son before his son even began writing, actually before he began reading. Martin, around about the time of he was 15, decided that he wanted to be a writer. And I think he must have decided because it seemed like his father was leading the kind of life he thought would be an enjoyable one. That's one sort of legacy he left him. The other thing he did was he didn't really push his son in any way. When it became clear that that Martin wanted to be a writer, he neither encouraged nor discouraged him. And Martin thought originally that this was a product of indolence, but he later came to think, well, maybe this was a wise parental instinct on his father's part. So one thing he gave him was the image of a pleasurable and enjoyable writing life. The other thing he gave him was freedom. He didn't push him in any way. And then in a variety of other ways, they seem to have been extraordinarily compatible. The enjoyment they took from each other, both in terms of the sense of humor they had and the shared interests, they had brought them very closely together. They did have rivalrous feelings, and it was necessary for the son to kind of accommodate himself to his father's unreasonableness. I mean, it usually went that way rather than the other way around, but for some reason or another, Martin was able to do it, and as he says, to write for reasons other than sort of Oedipal desire to get back in some way at the father.
Yes, I mean, he sounds like an exemplary son, actually, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But what about literary talent itself? Do you think it's inherited in any way?
No, I don't know. I really don't know. What, you mean whether there's a writerly gene?
Something like that. A kind of, a writerly way of looking at the world, a communication gene?
Yes, I think that that's the case. I mean, I certainly think that his father and all the people who amused his father and were his friends, his mother, even though she wasn't a writer, and his stepmother, certainly, who was a novelist, they all had a fascination with language, with common usage, what it reveals about social class and education and so forth. And they were also, his family were terrific mimics, and Martin is a very good mimic himself, not quite as good as his father. And the family claims that Kingsley Amis's older son, Philip, is the best of all the mimics in the family. But the sense that when you tell a story, you do the voices, you inhabit the characters a little bit, is a family tradition that not all families have, but it's very useful if you want to be a writer, or it might be an encouragement to become a writer, to think about language in that way.
It may often be a modelling of the work ethic. Certainly both Martin Amis and Virginia Woolf have spoken about the need for a writer to be selfish, to be ruthless in terms of making the writing the most important thing. Is that sort of modelling important?
Well, yes. I mean, it's not just that his father gave him an image of the writing life as a pleasurable life, and a profitable one as well. But he also instilled in him the sort of Puritan work habits that Amis's own father gave him. And with it also, as you say, a sense of entitlement, a sense that, this is what comes first, and other considerations such as the family and so forth really have to take a second place. Whenever there were difficulties in the family, say financial difficulties and so forth, which would worry other members of the family, Kingsley Amis just simply put his head down and worked. And I don't think Martin has ever opened a bill or anything like that. I mean, he leaves it to other people and just is very disciplined about his work.
Well, Barbara Kane, with me, would you describe Virginia Woolf's childhood as a literary one?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, her father had she knew, and her father knew by the time she was 11 that she was going to be a writer. But on the other hand, she had three siblings, and they weren't writers. And so the issue about the transmission of the gene, I mean, there are many families, and those Victorian families are particularly good examples, where one child is the writer and many of the other children are not.
But sometimes families are like that, even if there are quite a few people who could potentially do the same thing. As long as the older siblings doing X, then everyone has to do not X.
Yes, no, I think that's true. But writing was sort of part of her childhood. So she and her siblings had a newspaper, the Hyde Park News, which was written very carefully. Lytton Strachey's family was the same. So in that kind of way, writing for others to read is something that happens in childhood. And there's a kind of, I mean, obviously it's a very complicated development, but it's what you do in some way or another, and then it moves into writing essays, and then in her case, obviously, into writing novels. So I think the literariness is absolutely crucial, and the value given to the library and the books.
And tell us about the library
reading.
And the books.
Well, in Virginia Woolf's case, I mean, her father was quite conservative in terms of thinking about women. So although there were good girls' schools at the time and women could go to university, she wasn't allowed to do that. And so much of her education occurred in his library, reading his books and then having private lessons. And his library continued to be part of her library. I mean, so her library, his library was carried on. And but that notion about growing up knowing the standard English authors with a really deep knowledge of English literature and literary tradition, I think, is part and parcel of what she took for granted. And so in that sense, books had an incredible kind of importance. And then the friends, I mean, similar to Martin Amis, Henry James coming to tea, George Meredith, or Leslie Stephen had known George Eliot, although Virginia Woolf didn't. So in that sense, it's a world in which it's so much the kind of currency of what happens, I think.
Was it a matter of overhearing conversations, or did these people take the child seriously?
That's an interesting one. I think in lots of ways it was probably, in her case, a matter of overhearing conversations as a child. Although later on, I mean, her father, you know, Leslie Stephen died in 1904 when she was still quite young. And so for her, there's a sort of negotiation of the older generation of meeting Henry James in the street and him wanting to make comments about her life, which was no longer the kind of life his friend would have liked. So that's a rather different one about a sort of Victorian to Edwardian transition, in which you're carrying with you, as she's very aware, I think, in that sense, that she wants to be much more critical of these people and their work, right, you know, and she's polite to them because they were her father's friend. She has to free herself in that way from a world that continues to exist and to sort of dominate literary tastes in some ways.
Did she want to emulate her father's career?
No, I think she didn't, and I think the thing about becoming a novelist is really important. So, I mean, she wrote enormous numbers of essays, but I think she was quite critical of him. I mean, I think she did feel that he was in some ways a kind of second-rate mind with aspirations to genius, which he didn't quite measure up to. And I think the portrait of Mr. Ramsay in To the Lighthouse is quite an accurate representation of how she felt about him, of a whole family and a world being required to ensure his greatness. I mean, she comments in A Room of One's Own also on how women are expected to magnify men, to show them back to themselves at twice their normal size. I think that is a sense of her father, and that she wanted a new way to go, but she was aware of him all the time.
What about family connections and her being published?
Hugely important. I mean, especially the essays. I mean, when she wanted to become a professional writer, to earn her living writing, which she did in her early 20s, then, of course, almost all the Times Literary Supplement, the National Review, the newspapers and journals that published her work were all family connections in some way or another. And, of course, you know, her father had been the editor of the Dictionary of National Biography, so she knew people and her name was known, and that absolutely smoothed the pathway. Commissions came from connections.
Well, Tom Flood, joining us from Sydney, when you were younger, was it obvious to you as a child that writing and reading were important activities?
I mean, it was always something that was around the house, and there was a good library in the house, especially of Australian literature, but quite wide too. I can remember picking up books like Zola and being quite amazed by it when I was about 10 or 12 or something. But it wasn't an activity that we took much notice of as kids.
So there were a few of you, or your sister?
Yeah, five children.
Five children, yeah.
Yeah.
And your sister is an academic, isn't she? She writes other kinds of things.
Yeah, Kate is an academic and a poet, and I have another cousin who's a poet, Lucy Dugan, as well. So I think that, you know, there's obviously an effect there. There's three people involved with the family end up being writers.
So what was the household like? How was writing part of it? Was it obvious that people, you know... wrote on the kitchen table, or was there a sort of secret study somewhere that the writer secreted themselves
in? It sort of worked itself up as Mum got more successful, really. I can remember her and my stepdad, Merv, Ronioing out their first poetry book, probably about 1961, I think. What About the People? They were Ronioing that out on the dining room table. They had these old hand wound printing presses, and that may have no, I don't think that affected Kate, but she was 1 year old and was under the table and lying in amongst the pages that were coming out, they came out wet and they were blue, and I remember her skin getting imprinted lit with poetry, I suppose.
Well, that was a very writerly observation to make as a young boy, Tom.
Well, I just recalled it anyway. But, yeah, it's the kind of question you often get asked.
So did your mum say things like, you know, you really must read this and, I mean, she was a communist, so, you know, they were really interested in influencing people outside the family. Yeah. And was she really interested in influencing the way you thought?
We did get dragged along to a lot of political rallies and May Day marches and all kinds of things, but that sort of stopped when she stopped being a communist, basically, or when both of them stopped being a communist, which would have been the invasion of Czechoslovakia, I think, 68, probably somewhere around there. So I was about 13 then. But, yeah, throughout my young childhood, and with my father as well, because he was a communist as well, Les Flood, in Sydney, that was all pretty political. Although I was very small then, that was very political. I think we squatted in a house in Redfern at first and then lived in Rockdale. So the politics was very to the forefront in the early years, and I don't remember too much about writing at all.
Did they make you read The Russians?
We did have some Russian children's books and things like that translated, though, into English. I think there was one called, I'm not sure if it was Russian, but
Tractor or something.
No, it was called Dunno, actually. It was just about a little boy. It was a classic children's book. I don't think we had any other. We did have Russian picture books like, you know, The Great Works of Russia kind of thing, and Stalingrad, The Banks of the River, picture books mainly, you know, with photography of Russia. And we had a lot of Russian folk art and things around the house like that, you know. Various, like, sort of pictures painted on wood and, I don't know, silver steins and things like this. You know, there was always something coming back from Russia whenever Mum visited Russia when we were young.
So did your mother's politics and the things that she was interested in writing about shape your sense of what you wanted to write about?
I think it can't help but do that to some degree. In that you imbibe it from a very young age, but that's a hard one to answer. I think, on the face of things, no. I write very differently and was interested in very different kind of writing than my mother. But I think there is an underswell there that still leads to much the same things. There's a kind of a romantic vision, I suppose, which she was very swept up in, and I was. Thought that I was quite anti that vision, I suppose. But when I think about it, deeper in that, there's a kind of a spiritual connection that, and I'm not talking about the church here, that is connected to maybe the country. It's maybe a nationalistic connection. I know it's not very clear, but it's not a clear thing. It was a desire to express the inexpressible. I think that might have come through.
Or that it was maybe possible to approach the inexpressible.
At least to look at it anyway, or try to. And I think that is partly in the romantic vision and it's partly in my writing.
Well, you're on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National, and we're talking about the inheritance of writing, literary legacies. And I'm speaking with Thackeray Leader, who's in London, Professor of English Literature at Roehampton University, Barbara Kane, Professor of History at Monash University in Melbourne, and Tom Flood, who's a writer who's in Sydney and who's the son of Australian writer Dorothy Hewitt. Now, Thackeray Leader, can you talk a little bit about Martin Amis's the milieu in which he was brought up in, the people, the ideas, the culture? How important are all these things in an account of him as a writer?
Well, they're important in a number of ways. As with your other guest who was talking about Virginia Woolf, when Martin Amis left Oxford, he got a job at the TLS. He wrote a few reviews, and the friends of his father and his stepmother, both of whom were writing, quite casually said, "Well, you know, I like your reviews. If you ever have a book, let me know." And when he did write his first novel, The Rachel Papers, it was almost an experience. It was a kind of just a sort of domestic business. He got his father's publisher, he got his father's agent, and he was off. I mean, the novel is very funny and extremely impressive for a 24-year-old to have written, and it won the Somerset Maugham Award as his own father's first novel, Lucky Jim, did.
So do you reckon he would have been published if he hadn't been who he was?
Yes, I do, but I mean, he might have had to have struggled a little for it to happen. There's that practical business. The other thing is he was friendly with many the writers of his father's generation because he had an easy and comfortable relation with his father. He had a comparable relation with many of his father's friends who were writers, and the friends of his stepmother and so forth. And so he knew lots of writers, and he immediately became associated when he, I mean, after he worked at the TLS, he worked at the New Statesman, and I think he was the editor of the books pages. And he found himself surrounded with an extraordinary circle of people. Christopher Hitchens worked with him, and the poet James Fenton, and Julian Barnes, and so forth. And as his father had been the center of a grouping of writers that was influential, the so-called movement writers, Philip Larkin and John Wayne and Donald Davey and so forth. So the son became the center of a grouping of writers. It wasn't given a name, but it was associated with the New Statesman, as his father's circle had been associated with the Spectator. And it was fashionable and influential, and all these things came from, there's no doubt that he was connected to a metropolitan literary culture, and though he made his own way in it, his father's life was an example of how it could be done and also helped to facilitate it.
Do you think that Martin Amis's memoir, Experience, which recalls this childhood full of anecdotes about people he came in contact with and, you know, his development as a young man, do you think it's important that it was written and published after his father's death?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think it was, in a way, it was it was probably only possible after his father's death. Not just because it revealed things about his father that his father might have been embarrassed to see in print, though I don't think
I can't imagine him being embarrassed about anything.
No, but maybe because of the affection it expressed, I don't know for sure. I mean, I think it's one of Martin Amis's best books. I'm pretty sure his father would have liked it, but maybe he needed the distance from it. I mean, when he was working on it, I was editing his father's letters, and he was completely immersed in his father's life and the details of his life. Though he took a kind of impressionistic, non-chronological view of the life and the relationship, rather artfully interwoven, which is quite different from the edition of the letters, which just goes chronologically. But maybe he just needed the distance from his father. But I don't think there was anything very complicated in terms of rivalrous feelings that he had to work out or over in order to write the memoir.
Well, Barbara Cain, what about Virginia Woolf? To the Lighthouse was her most autobiographical book. Was she trying to work something out between her and her parents there?
Oh, no, she absolutely was in that one. And she talked about the fact that she'd thought about her parents. She'd been obsessed by them up until that, and that the writing of that book laid them to rest for her. And she
but
felt
most writers are obsessed with their parents, aren't they? I mean, their first novels or their first works really is about what they know so well, which is about where they come from.
Yeah, so this isn't her first novel. I mean, she'd written novels before, so it's her first really successful novel. And I think that's true. But, I mean, she had a much more contentious or much more conflictual relationship with her father, because she also wrote, after she'd finished To the Lighthouse, she said on her father's death, she remembered him, and his life would have ended hers, that if had he lived, no books, no writing would have been possible. It's unthinkable. And in part, that's a kind of father-daughter thing, and it's also a Victorian father and a daughter. And I think she's referring there to, you know, the incredible and inordinate demands that Leslie Stephen made of the women in his life for continual and constant support and reinforcement and solace, and the refusal to allow them a kind of autonomous life.
Or was she maybe also talking about the loss of the father early at that young stage in her life, and the effect that had on her as a person and a writer?
Well, I mean, in some ways, but I do think that by the time her father died, while it was a loss, it was a freedom from what she and her sister Vanessa had come to see as intolerable oppression, because their mother had died much, much earlier, and their older half-sister had died, and stepsister, not half-sister. And so they were the ones who were running the house, particularly Vanessa, and providing him with this constant solace and support. So I don't think, I mean, I think that, you know, I think there is an area of loss of the father. And actually, she uses the term ambivalent about it And she talks about, this is an unusual term and it comes from Freud, and she felt, so she talks about the way in which she felt about her father. There's no question that, you know, she was very bound to him in that sort of way. But I think she probably was right, that she needed the freedom of his absence to be able to write in a way that I think kind of men are, well, it's hard to know about men and their fathers, but in her case, this was a very particular thing. And I think she also felt, she felt the kind of weight of a masculine establishment. So she felt that while people asked her to write things, they patronised her, and that she was battling to be heard as an independent voice, you know, as a serious autonomous writer.
Now, Tom Flood, did you feel a certain anxiety, or did you feel in any way in competition with your mother when you began to write?
No, I don't think so. It was, although I didn't enter the fields that she was in, because which was largely drama and poetry, and I had certainly no desire to go into poetry, although my sister did and my cousin did. But and drama, maybe I have written a little bit of drama. But I don't think there was much competition either way with us. We're both pretty supportive of each other. And once I started to write, that brought me and my mother closer, I think. And I was, for instance, before I even began to write, I was already critiquing some of her works, particularly when she turned back to the novel. I certainly was critiquing that, but I'd already had my novel out by then. She'd had a novel out in the late 50s, Bobbin' Up,
yeah,
which was pretty successful, certainly behind the Iron Curtain anyway. and she wanted to get back to the novel. She was disenchanted with theatre in Australia and her place in it, I suppose, and was eager to get back to the novel. And this would have been in the early 90s now. And that I think that drew us a bit closer, the fact that I was looking at her novels and we were talking about them and how to write them. I think that, and that had a big influence on me, probably because, I mean, academia has always been strong in my family, and there's quite a few academics in my family, but there have been. And Mum was an academic for a period until she became a full-time writer. I think that led me on to running the service I run now, Flood Manuscripts, which is basically a manuscript assessment, mentoring, an editing service for writers in Australia.
So do you think that because she was your mother and not your father, then that meant that you weren't inclined to be rivalrous? I mean, was she more...
It could be the mother-son thing, yeah. I'm not sure, yeah. Yeah. I was wondering about that with your missus. You know, it's male to male there, you know, so maybe that is that case. I don't know. We just didn't seem to have that competitive thing, and she was very supportive in the main. I mean, she was the one who was the writer. I was just trying it out kind of thing, you know. And she wanted to be a writer from the age of four. I never wanted to be a writer. And I was always going to be a musician, and I am a musician. But
so what possessed you?
I think I'd come to a bit of an impasse in music. Our band had broken up, and I just wondered at the time whether I could... And I had been songwriting for a while, and I wondered whether I could write something longer than a song. And I was reading a lot of fiction at the time. That was would have been the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s in Australia. And there was a big boom in fiction at the time in Australia. We had people like Peter Carey putting out some pretty fascinating stuff, and David Ireland, still some of my favourite Australian fiction. So that's what possessed me, I suppose.
Did she read your work?
She certainly read Oceana Fine. She read one of the early drafts of Oceana Fine, and I had to send it to her in WA because she was on tour with a play, I'm not sure. And I sent that to about eight people. She was one of them, and she was only three of them came back with anything sensible. And or useful, I should say, and she was one of them. So she read that, yeah.
And how did she feel about you getting received a number of awards early on?
Yeah, there was three awards. That's how that book came to be published. It got the Australian Vogel Award, or the manuscript did, I should say, and it came to be published from that, and that was pure chance. Like the other speakers have all talked about the influence or the, you know, the... the situation that there was plenty of influence around to allow them to be published, Virginia Woolf and Martin Amis, yeah? That didn't occur in my family. Mum didn't have that influence. She was a well-known Australian writer, but it was in poetry and drama, and she knew nothing about major publishers in Australia at that time. Later on she did. But at that time she knew nothing, and she didn't know what I should do with this book, you know? So someone else suggested I put it in the Vogel Award, and then it sort of went on its trail to finally win the Miles Franklin.
Well, Zachary Leader, we know that there was a big rivalry between father and son in the Amos family. Kingsley didn't like many of Martin's books. He wasn't Martin's ideal reader, was he? He was really a rotten father when it comes to this. I just sort of think it's appalling the sorts of things he said about his son's work. What did he say?
Well, the appalling things that he said about his son's writing, the admission that he made in public, also in private to his son, that he found it very difficult to read his novels. I think these remarks mostly come from the first half of the 1980s, when he was deeply unhappy and had a kind of breakdown. Martin Amis's novel Money was published in 1984, which was about the lowest point in Amis's life. He had been blocked for a couple of years in writing and was really at sea because he couldn't write. His wife had left him in 1980. He was alone and terrified of being alone and so forth. And the way he reacted to all this, in addition to drinking an awful lot, was to be a kind of aggressive and testing and provocative, and just about everybody got it. And he felt he was able to speak openly about the things he didn't like about his son's novel. I mean, I don't know very many people who could have handled a father publicly disapproving of one's writing. And Martin certainly was hurt by it, but he seems to have been able to handle it. I think some part of it has to do with their differences as writers. Kingsley Amis, the father, had a very strong sense of genre and generic decorum, and he also had a great sense of writing as craft, and set about at a certain point in his life to make sure he had a go at every different kind of fiction, every sort of popular as well as highbrow fiction. He wrote a ghost story and a classic detective novel and a historical novel and a science fiction novel and so forth and so on. And in addition to being a novelist, he was a poet, and he had a clear sense of the sorts of the sorts of things poems can do, which he thought were not the sorts of things that novels ought to do. Or that is, the language of poetry had more resources to call upon than the language of fiction. And his son, Martin, doesn't write poetry and loads every rift with ore. And is those people who don't like his style talk about it as being sort of highly charged, overwritten, full of tricks and self-advertising. In some ways, his models were, in many ways, his models were his father, but in other ways, his models were Nabokov and Saul Bellow. Amis disapproved of this. He thought this is not the way fictional prose should be written.
Was Martin close to Saul Bellow while his father was still alive?
Oh yes, yeah.
And how did Senior regard this? A usurping of the position?
Oh well, not really. I mean, they really had a very good relationship. They could tease each other about these things. They had all kinds of disagreements, not just artistic ones and literary disagreements, but political and other disagreements. And the son understood that the father's curmudgeonliness, his aggression in the expression of his feelings, was partly a game, partly a way of testing the loyalty of people around him, and he managed somehow or other to negotiate them. And he never was ever in any doubt about his father's love for him. And also it was clear to all their friends that these two people admired each other and admired each other's intelligence, even though they might have disagreed about the sorts of ingredients that ought to go into a novel or which government should be in power. They had they were on the same wavelength in terms of their sense of humor. They shared many, many literary champions and so forth, as well as the ones they disagreed on. They had, they both knew the poetry of Philip Larkin by heart. And
So is Martin growing into his father?
Is he growing into his father?
Yeah.
He's starting to look a little more like his father, but do you mean is he becoming a terrible curmudgeon and a right wing bore and so forth? No, I don't think so.
So, but I suppose the last question is, you know, is it poison chalice? Is it a fantastic thing to be born into such a family? What do you how do you feel about it?
Well, I'm at work now on a biography of Saul Bellow, who had three sons, at least two of whom tried to become writers and had a very strong sense that that if they didn't actually become writers and succeed in becoming writers, they'd never really attain the kind of closeness with their father that they sought.
Well, I think I'll have to stop you there because we're running out of time. And Tom Flood, would you say it was a poison chalice or a fantastic thing that you were born into the family you were?
Yeah, I think it's... I would go with the second. it's definitely something of a blessing, I think. Although it is also, I always think of writing as a blessing and a curse.
So everything's a bit of a blessing and a curse, really,
well,
if you look at it very closely.
Yeah, I always say it's rather like going to the family hardware store too.
Yes.
Joining it, I mean, to work in it.
That's right. And Barbara Kane, what do you think?
I think in Virginia Woolf's case, it was a blessing. I mean, it was a complicated blessing, but it was a blessing. I mean, I think that she really, it offered her opportunities that it would have been harder to find elsewhere, and it gave her material to work on that she used in very inventive kinds of ways. Of course, in her case, she's a novelist coming from a family that is full of historians and biographers and essayists, so she's both able to chart a new path for herself but also to use all the time this kind of inheritance that that allows her to write, and the context that assist her in doing so.
So it is an inheritance, in fact, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's a cultural inheritance, though. That's the issue. It's not just a biological inheritance. It's a kind of cultural and social inheritance, and it's terribly hard to disentangle those things.
And it's political inheritance too, isn't it? I mean, the politics of publishing.
Yes. Yes, and in some ways also the politics of opposition. I mean, Leslie Stephen was an opposition figure. Virginia Woolf had different kinds of opposition, but there's a sort of stance of independent thought that I think is important.
Well, thank you all to all the guests today to have made this topic a little bit clearer to us. Zachary Leader, Professor of English Literature at Roehampton University, speaking to us from his home in London. He's the author of the official biography of the life of Kingsley Amis, published by Jonathan Cape in 2006. And Barbara Kane, Professor of History at Monash University. Her most recent book is Bombay to Bloomsbury, a biography of the Strachey family, published by Oxford University Press. And Tom Flood, author of the 1990 Miles Franklin Award winner Oceania Fine, who also runs his own manuscript assessment business from his home in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales.